once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, second hour, on this Saturday, March 25th, 2017. And the telephone number to call in here, 254-773-1400. And,
yes.
You know, those of you who are listening online didn't hear the news. At least I don't think they heard the news.
No, they did not.
Then, but if you're listening on the AM radio frequency 1400, you heard that the big issue is to focus on jobs. And therein, folks, is
there
a
is a problem.
The
big issue that the Trump administration is coming out and say they're focusing now on American jobs.
Well, right? The problem is the Labor Department released the Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of our two most favorite government agencies.
Most favorite bureaucracies because they admit to being so.
Right. The Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I love them. Anyway, they come out with lots of numbers that we geekily look at, and we look at these big tables and so on. The problem with creating more jobs in America is if you go to the big manufacturing states, one of which, by the way, is Colorado. I know a lot of people don't know that. Indiana, places like that. You'll notice if you read their reports, the unemployment rate is below 3%. Now, any economics class you go to about the United States economy and so on says that under absolutely optimal circumstances, 3% typically are moving between jobs in the United States. Therefore, a 3% unemployment rate is full employment. There's nobody left to hire off the street.
Just as an example, if you've got a church or a business community that you're involved in, if there's 100 people in that room and they're all really good at what they do, 3 of those people are moving from one job to another. So this is optimal. We don't expect that that the entire American economy is built up of people that are absolutely the best at what they do. When we have a 3% unemployment rate, we're talking about full employment. We are at a point where trying to hire new people means that you have to go to people who don't have jobs and convince them to leave the job they're in to come to you.
Now, obviously, the United States unemployment rate is at, 4.7 right now?
Right.
But that's because there are places like Puerto Rico with 12% unemployment. And that's not going to change anytime in the near future, and I'm not even going to touch this to try to figure out why. Or there's Cleveland, Ohio, with its 6% unemployment rate. And there's Louisiana, which Louisiana and Mississippi perpetually have high unemployment rates, and Lord knows why. But they do. Alaska has a 6.4% unemployment rate. Alabama has 6.2. I have no idea why they consistently, but they always have that. For Alabama, for example, 6.2 is as low as it typically ever gets. 6% is about as low as it gets in Alabama for reasons known only to God, I suppose. But the point is that and New Mexico typically has a higher unemployment rate. And oddly enough, in a lot of states, there's an almost perfect correlation between the state income tax level and the level of unemployment until you get to New England. And in New England, they have amazingly low unemployment and high state income taxes, so you can't say that that's working either. The issue here is that focusing on creating more jobs in an economy where we're business leaders across the board are saying we can't find enough people to take the jobs that are open now. For instance, and some people have questioned me on this. All I got to say is drive down the highway and look at the back of the 18-wheelers.
Drivers wanted.
Go into Austin, go into any town and look at storefronts, and you see that.
And they've had those signs up for a long time.
They're begging to hire people. And so anybody who wants to have a job there, and you could say, well, yeah, but they're not getting $23 an hour. No. And
they are if they're driving a truck.
I don't know if they even get $23 an hour driving a truck. It's cents per mile, and I don't know if it's 20. I don't think it's 20. But anyway, the point is there's a shortage of skilled labor in the United States, and we're seeing increasingly a shortage of unskilled labor in the United States. In other words, we got jobs to do that don't take a lot of training, that pay a reasonable wage.
For not a lot of training.
And we can't find anybody to work at those jobs, even when they're not particularly unpleasant. At that point, saying we want to create more jobs in the United States is counterproductive. What we need in the United States is, we said this in the newsletter that just came out, we are short leadership, meaning there's a lot of cash, a lot of capital that belongs to corporations in the United States that they could be investing to increase productivity so that even without more workers, we can produce more stuff and make more money in the corporations and get the economy going again. And once they start doing that, they can raise the wages of the people who are making more stuff without creating inflation. And then the people with the raised wages can go out and buy more stuff. And that's a really wonderful cycle that has kicked in a number of times in the history of the United States. And we've had really good GDP growth when that happens. It's not happening, and it's not happening. The surveys of the CEOs say it's not happening because they don't know, they can't predict what the taxes are going to be. They can't predict what federal spending is going to be. They can't predict what regulations are going to be. And as a result, they sit on their cash because of uncertainty.
Yeah. If we could get one of those rare moments in history where we could get Democrats and Republicans to form kind of a centrist coalition. This happened a few years back. John McCain, and he had a gang of it started out as a gang of 10 and then slowly changed to a gang of 6. And these were senators that were willing to step across the aisle, Democrats and Republicans that were willing to talk together and try to make some form of movement forward. We're not getting that. And I know a lot of the Democrats say, well, we don't want to work with the Republicans. And a lot of the Republicans are saying, we don't want to work with the Democrats. If we don't get that, then there is absolutely no assurance to anyone in business as to what's going to happen in the future. Because if it's a constant political tug of war, if every issue is a us or them rather than we're all Americans, we don't know what to expect because we might get regulatory reform, but if the Democrats aren't in on it and the next president is a Democrat or the next time we have a House election or a Senate election, we have Democrats, we should just expect that to get repealed because if it's passed with no Democrats, then when the Democrats take power, then they're going to pass it with no Republicans and back and forth. When we're talking about healthcare, the fact is that it's been 7 years since the Affordable Care Act was passed, since Obamacare became law. And in that time period, the beginning time period, all of the juicy things, the things that were written about by Nixon and by Reagan were put into effect. The Republicans didn't get to grab those things and take credit for them. They're the things that already happened and the Democrats had them. So now to fix the rest of it, the only things that they could do were not very good things for the law, and that made it very difficult to pass. Now, what we have under the Affordable Care Act is increasing deficits into the future. We have more entitlement, more state spending, more taxes. Is that bad? Well, evidently not to the American people, because the people, you know, the 58% of Americans is part of the reason why this Republican bill didn't pass. 58% of the people didn't want that bill passed. Some of them were Democrats who didn't want it passed because it would replace something that they like. And some of them were Republicans because it didn't go far enough in repealing.
Did you see the number who did want it passed?
No.
17.
Okay, 17% said, hey, we should do this.
Yes.
Which tells you something. It says that the priorities of Congress are wrapped up in the priorities of Congress rather than the priorities of their constituents. And they're allowed to do that for a little bit because we just had an election. They don't have to worry about re-election for a while. This is part of the reason why they got elected, by yelling about something that was easy to say, it's broken. But if you'll recall, during the election, we spent a lot of time talking about how you cannot make forward progress by only talking about what's broken and not how to fix it. So the how to fix it needs to be more important than the break. When you say it's broken, it's broken, it's broken, it's broken, and then you try to fix it and you can't fix it, well, now it's still broken. Everybody's admitted it's broken at this point, but the people in charge of fixing it can't fix it because they don't want to work together.
So let's go on to the economy.
Real quick, one final thing there. If I had employees that were this insistent about not working together when they're supposed to be doing the same job, a lot of them would get fired. We don't have that kind of environment in a business. You don't have, I mean, unless it's a government-run business where departments will not talk to each other and they will not cooperate to get things done, because that's the antithesis of doing anything correctly. We have, in some ways, my perfect dream of the world is to have a totally inefficient government. Well, now that I have this dream become reality, I realize that we kind of do need government to work together a little bit. So the Republicans have to suck it up. They're in charge now. They should be doing what we teach our kids. If you win a ball game, you be a good sportsman. And the Republicans and the Democrats are both horrible sportsmen right now. After they win, they just rub it in each other's faces. They do the things that are the worst possible things to each other, and then are surprised when they lose and the same thing happens to them. There it is. That's it. Now we can move on to the economy.
Okay. We're so focused on Washington right now, we're missing what is in essence some good news. And I think what we're going
to
see.
Good stuff too. Yeah.
I think what we're going to see this quarter is a couple of things. First off, they don't report corporate earnings in the local newspaper, so you're not going to see the good news. You're probably going to see a very low GDP at the end of the first quarter, which is coming up again in about a month.
We just had a big snowstorm in the Northeast.
You're going to see another low GDP, and the reason you're going to see a low GDP is there's a lot of things that have trended downward. They kind of kicked in at the end of the fourth quarter, and a lot of the optimism has not translated into spending and investing. And by investing, I mean investing in infrastructures and things like that. So you're probably going to see another first quarter low GDP, which is pretty normal now. We begin to understand that first quarter
is going to be a little bit of a pain every year.
You're also probably going to see, if you follow this, and we do, of course, is corporate earnings for the quarter. We're a couple of weeks, less than 2 weeks away. We're about a week away from the end of the quarter. So now we're able to take a look at what's going on in the corporations. Corporate earnings are probably going to come in higher than most people expect. And that's good for the stock market. It's good for stocks in general. And I think we're going to see some healthy growth, because there was some release of cash at the end of last year to invest in things, which meant corporations were buying things from each other. They're buying things from lots of places. And it's going to kind of kick into gear, and we're going to see some growth in that area. Car and truck sales are down a little bit right now, primarily because there were so many bought last year. So what we're seeing across the board in the United States is a lot of slow, consistent economic growth in the background, but nothing that would cause it to break out and shoot upward. And we may not like that, but what that means in essence is this expansion that we have going on right now is going to keep going probably for quite a while longer. Now,
there's two areas that we look at regularly, and we've had some conversation about this, because people tend to have a big chunk of their investment sitting in the ground that they're living in and in the house that is on top of that ground, and that is the value of real estate. Real estate for existing homes, year over year, February to February, prices are up 7.7% for existing homes. That sounds like really good news. For The difference between January and February, existing sales dropped 3.7%. That sounds like bad news. So I'm just saying the prices are up 7.7%. Sales are good. And over from a year ago, sales are up a lot. But we just had a dip in that upward movement. And part of that dip was due to another piece of information, and that is that new, not existing, single-family homes, the sales increased 6.1%, which is something I've talked about on the air over the past few months about being aware that interest rates as they go up are going to have a downward push on prices for existing homes, that the upward push in prices that we're seeing has to do with supply and demand. There's a lot of people that are coming to the market right now that have been saving for a long time. Household formations have been really slow for about a decade. They are coming out with their cash and starting to buy. And that's had a huge upward push to the price of houses over the last several years. My statement over the past few months has been, don't get too used to that. We only have 3 to 5 years of that. We may have less than that. The builders are coming in very quickly. So new home sales rising 6.1% at the same time that existing houses, their sales dropped 3.7% from January to February, says that the builders are kicking in and new houses are being built, and these new households, these new young people that have been saving for a long time, the vast majority of them do not want to buy a house that's been around for a while. They want to buy a new house that's their house. So as the builders kick in, that's going to have another downward push on the price of houses. We still probably have multiple years of that, but I might be thinking that we have less time than the 3 to 5 years. We may only have 2 to 3 years. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about, if you say, I'm going to sell my house, but I'm going to let it ride upward for a while, it may be a good time to sell the house. You shouldn't be trying to time the market for your house, by the way. You should be trying to say what you want to do with your overall life. And if that does well and coincides with good prices, you should take advantage of it. Don't try to eke out all the growth you can get, or you might outlast the growth. That's kind of key there. And I talked about this a bit in the past, but those two numbers are both good numbers. Year over year, sales of existing and new houses are way up. Prices are up. That's good if you're not buying. It's not good if you're buying. If you're out there trying to find a house, it's probably better to do it right away or wait a couple of years. If you're trying to sell a house, it's probably better to do it over the next year or so.
There's another piece of good news I think is important. The Institute for Supply Management the ISM has its Purchasing Managers Index, so it becomes the ISM PMI. Don't you love it?
ISM PMI. Let's throw some more letters in there. Are you just getting it from your soup? Just lay it all on the spoon and start naming letters as you go. We have a ZX PMI. Anyway, go ahead.
The
alphabet soup.
The PMI for the United States, the Index of Supply Management Purchase Managers Index, is a pretty important thing because when a company wants to manufacture something, they turn to their purchase managers and give them advance notice saying we need the following items or the following raw materials several months before they actually want to manufacture the item, because it takes a while to find all the pieces and parts and materials it takes to manufacture something. And the index is set up so that 50 is neutral. Anything below 50 means that the orders are shrinking. Anything above 50 means the orders are growing. And we're setting at 57.7, which is exceptionally good. It's far better than it was, for example, in 2007 when we had a boom going in the economy and nobody knew that everything was about to collapse. It is comparable to the peak as we were coming out of the recession. So we have within the basic side of the economy where things are made, which is a key thing to look at, we have an indicator that says over the next 6 months or so, we're going to see some pretty significantly increasing activity. We don't know exactly what all that's for, of course, that's not part of the forecast, but it's there. And we're seeing the same thing pretty much across the board with economic activity in the United States. Now, that's good news. Better news, and this may sound a little strange, is that that same...
That assumes that everything we haven't said up till now is not a little strange. I mean,
but it's better news is that the Eurozone PMI, which is calculated the same way, they call around in the place where the euro is used for currency and talk to purchasing managers.
They just have to know a lot more languages there.
That's true. But these purchase managers in Europe have seen the index there is in the 56 range. And that is amazingly high. It was negative for a long time. They actually went through one of the things that I like a lot of Americans are unaware of is beginning in 2012, the Eurozone was in a recession. And
some of the Eurozone still is.
That's right. They still are. But the point is, we're seeing every indication we're seeing in the Eurozone now is they have emerged from the recession and are beginning to grow. They've come back up out of the negatives and they're beginning to grow. Now, the European Central Bank is continuing to have stimulative investments made. The reason it took them so long to come out, by the way, is they were very reticent about doing what our central bank did, which was pumping money into the economy, because the Germans are terrified of inflation, and as a result, they got deflation. And now they finally acknowledged, yeah, well, maybe we need to do something about this, and they started doing it. And things have really started turning around. And you can look back to Ben Bernanke and say that guy was a genius, because his method of fixing things brought us out of the hole faster than Europe. And when Europe finally adopted his measures, they started recovering too.
Let me throw in a bit of history here, and this will help understand why it was that the Germans were so blind to this. The last time that we had major deflation before this episode here was in the Great Depression. And the Germans didn't have deflation during that time period. They had runaway inflation. This is during the time period when Hitler was coming to power. He was coming to power based on the runaway inflation, and he made it worse by devaluing the mark. So the Reichsmark back then, I have one of those just as a collector's item. In my childhood, we spent 3 years in Germany, and I have this old Reichsmark that basically, you could buy tons of those and paper your wall and spend less than wallpaper. That's runaway inflation. So our last Fed chairman studied the Great Depression as it affected the United States and the circumstances that led up to it. And we were able to compare that to the Great Recession and see that there were a lot of similarities. Well, the Germans at the time of the last Great Depression, the Great Depression, had just been the losers in a major war. And they didn't have people that were skilled to work, and they didn't have the factories that were producing the material. They had to build all that stuff up. So the government did this big stimulus when there wasn't anything to support it, which caused work to happen, but it didn't do it very well and caused runaway inflation. So rightly, the living memory of our oldest citizens includes deflation. The living memory of the oldest citizens of Germany does not include deflation. They only remember the terrors of inflation. So as we were busy trying to fight deflation, they were terrified that it was going to turn into inflation. It didn't fit them then, but they still had this emotional memory carried from their parents and grandparents. The people in charge knew people who were terrified that the money would become worthless rather than that the money would become too valuable. So all of their protections went the wrong direction. And we lucked out in some ways in that our institutional memory, our family memory, includes people putting money in the mattress instead of gluing it to the wall. So there it is for the history there of why the Germans were afraid, more afraid of inflation than we were, and took the wrong moves coming out of the Great Recession.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone numbers in here remain. Telephone number remains. I'm still back in the
days when we had multiples.
When we had multiple lines coming in. 254-773-1400. So give us a call if you have any comments or any questions about anything to do with the economy or investing. It's a good thing for us to talk about. It's a good thing for us to like to learn about from you. Your perspective on it, I think, is very important. And sometimes when we say these things, we miscommunicate. We say something that we think we know what we're saying, and we say it, and you hear it differently. So that's what the last call was about. And I think it's important that you call in when that happens. And I think it's important also, in the negativity that's going on in Washington right now, to take a look at the fact that the market dropped 1.5% on a massive failure of legislative leadership.
Yeah, and not that long ago, that was a daily movement in the market. Just right. You know, within the last 6 years, that was something that you could expect to see on any given day.
And the reason is, and I'm just going through the national economic indicators from the Federal Reserve, they are uniformly up. I mean, almost everything I look at in here, I say almost, literally everything I look at in here that has to do with how people are employed and where they're employed and how many people are employed and how much they're making is positive. Now, there's some really tiny little pieces here and there that are neutral or very slightly negative, but almost everything out there that looks forward to the future is in the positive range, and most of them are extremely positive. We have a lot of momentum in this economy.
Can I give a lot of health. Yes. Can I give an example of exactly what you're saying? You were just talking about the PMI. So that's these people that are making the decisions on what should be manufactured. And they tend to make those decisions based on the demand that they're seeing right now because they don't want to manufacture things that people aren't going to buy. So that index, the manufacturing index, is up. Those producers, the people that produce the manufacturing, see a demand going up. They see profitability in producing more things than manufacturing. Some of that is house building. Some of that is manufacturing in factories. A piece of the puzzle to throw in here is that oil is down 11% in the last 2 weeks. It's down 11% because some of the past manufacturing went back towards the oil industry. When OPEC cut back on oil and raised the price up above 50, a very minor amount of our manufacturing, just a few years ago, it was a major chunk of our manufacturing in the oil world. Well, the facilities are in place. The infrastructure is there now. A lot of the pipelines that were being built are finished. A lot of the drilling capacity that we overproduced a few years ago is still there and ready to be turned back on. So price went up. Not a whole lot of manufacturing was required to cause shale to come back online, and they are profitable at $48 a barrel, where before they needed $60 a barrel. OPEC's got some problems on the horizon, and that now the infrastructure's in place, we don't have to devote a huge amount of manufacturing potential to raising our production in oil again. Even when oil drops 11%, when the PMI comes out, and they're looking forward at new purchases, they have to take into account that the oil folks are not going to be buying a lot of new stuff with a drop of 11%. So the rest of manufacturing in the United States has stepped up. Some of that, as I said, is new houses. But a lot of it is other things. Car sales are up. Refrigerator sales are up. That's another number that I wanted to mention here is that durable good orders. You mentioned this in the newsletter. Durable good orders are up 1.7%. What is that? That's big machines that you have and you don't buy very often. They're durable. They last a long time. Refrigerators, washing machines, sometimes lawnmowers, big ones. Those are up because people feel comfortable replacing something that's not broken. And if you think back to the recession, if you were cutting and saving and cutting back on debt and you looked up and you said it sure would be nice to have one of those newfangled refrigerators or newfangled washers or dryers, you've probably purchased one since then, but you went a long time saying it'd be nice to have a new one before you bought it. At least the majority of America did. Now we've been buying them, and now we're increasing the speed at which we buy them. We're buying these new things because we're comfortable with the economic situation for ourselves, comfortable enough to replace things quicker than they're being broken. People are taking perfectly good refrigerators and taking them out to their garage to replace them with an even better, perfectly good refrigerator in their kitchen. So that's a really, really good side for the economy. These are the pieces that we're looking at when he's saying we're trying to find neutral and negatives in the bunch as far as the economy goes. Now, when we're looking at the stock market, expect some volatility there. Looking at the economy, man, things look good right now.
Yep. I mean, that's really it in a nutshell. Telephone number in here again, 254-773-1400, and we need to do some commercials.
Yes, we do. So
this
I will.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach.
I'm going to go ahead and play some commercials. Again, Personal Wealth Coach, if today is March 25th, the number to call in here, 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. There's an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal that I wanted to talk about.
Can we talk about the boring articles? We never talk about the boring
stuff. It's interesting
stuff.
To me, but it could be quite boring to anybody. And it,
okay,
and
that counts.
It explains, there's a paper that came out that addresses why the immigrant flow from south of the border has fallen off to the point where we, for example, actually have fewer illegal immigrants in the United States today than we did 5 years ago. We were at about 12.5 million. Now we're down to 11 and stabilized. And apparently the ones that are here and intend to stay. But we're not getting floods across the border like we got in the And the number of people coming across the border appears to be shrinking. And the study seems to indicate that there's a couple of things going on. The biggest one is improving economic opportunities south of the border. And that has a lot to do with NAFTA, by the way. It has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of things that previously were manufactured in the United States are now being manufactured in Mexico, which means that we don't have the labor shortages in the United States. They're able to be employed south of the border someplace, not just in Mexico, but in Guatemala and a number of other places that are in NAFTA. And they have a rising standard of living in those areas. Now, listen to this really weird part of this. As the standard of living has risen under NAFTA in Central America and Mexico is technically in North America, the birth rate has fallen off. And as the birth rate falls off, this is very typical within countries that where the standard of living goes up, they have fewer kids. And if they have steady employment and fewer kids, then they have lesser need for daddy to come north across the border. And NAFTA has now been in place long enough that there are fewer people. And you know, this is really strange. Because of the increased standard of living south of the border, there are fewer people entering the workforce, and there are more jobs for them to have, and they pay better than they did in the past. And what the paper predicts is that whether or not we put a wall up, which I don't think we're going to do because of the expense of putting it up in Texas, Whether or not we put a wall up across the entire border or do anything radical across the entire border, the flow of unskilled labor into the United States from south of the border is going to fall. It's going to continue to fall. It's going to be falling into the indefinite future, no matter what we do on this side. It is rather like a lot of other things that do with demographics. It is going to cause some massive shifts. Among other things, it means that we are facing in the United States, the paper noted, in the future, the biggest, probably the single biggest economic hurdle that we have to get over is a shortage of labor. If the United States economy is going to continue to grow and we're not going to get a high level of immigration, then we have got to find and invest in things like robotics, and we have to make that very attractive somehow. Again, some changes in the DAX code would probably be good to help that happen. It's not going to create new jobs in the United States. Well, it'll create new jobs. It just won't create a bunch of new unskilled jobs on assembly lines. But this is where we're going in the United States, and this is where we have to, if we wanted to aim something in some direction, the bottom line to it can be seen in what happened in Japan. Japan's demographics stink. They're basically not having enough kids to support the population. They're getting older. Yeah, they're in a little bit of a recession right now, but they haven't seen their standard of living drop. And the reason is because they have gone heavily, heavily into two areas. One, manufacturing overseas, mainly in the United States, I might add. And number two, robotics at home. And as our society matures, I think that's the direction we have to go. One, among other things, robots do not require healthcare. It's a lot.
They call that engineering.
Yeah, but they basically, it's
life support is not often the solution. Leaving them on life support for longer, right. They just unplug them and put them somewhere else.
But if a robot replaces a worker on an assembly line. It's not just a matter of that robot operates per hour cheaper than a worker operates per hour. The company doesn't have to have a pension fund for the robot. It doesn't have to have health care for the robot. The robot doesn't take vacations. And I know that it's kind of counterintuitive to say we can save our economy by replacing people with robots. But if we're not pointed in that direction and seriously pointed in that direction, a decade from now, we'll be hurting severely because we got to figure out where the next wave of productivity comes from. And that's crucial to try to figure that out because we're not going to get a lot of labor in to educate. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, I have trouble hearing the callers, so you might want to check on that.
Oh, we'd love to.
Okay. I have a hypothetical for you. I hear a lot of, but before I get to it, I hear a lot of people these days trying to get people to buy silver as a investment. Not gold, but silver. And I have a hypothetical for you. What if some old lady buys into that and spends a significant portion of her savings on silver, and then a recession hits? What will happen to her? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. It's a good question. There's a fundamental statement that we can make here. This is one that a lot of people have trouble with, but let's define the principle first. In order to expect a profit, you need to create value. And this is something you can prove in your own life. If you go to work and you don't work, you're not creating any value. You're not likely to have a job very long. The same is true if you're buying a machine for something that you do at work. If you're building something with the machine or using it to compute, if it's not adding value to your company, you're certainly not going to buy any more of it. You certainly aren't going to be able to look around and see if you can sell it at a profit to somebody else, because they're going to figure out you can't add profit with it either. You can't add value with it. gold and silver, or any commodity for that matter, there's a cost associated with the finding it, the refining it, the marketing it, putting it out there for people to buy. Once you have purchased it as a commodity, this isn't like oil where you can do something with it. Unless you're a jeweler, or unless you're making silverware or you're plating something, silver and gold, if you're buying it strictly as an investment, is you're buying it in the hope that somebody's going to want it more than you do right now, that they're willing to pay more for it later. It's based on an expectation of demand and an expectation of supply. If we find a lot more silver, if we get better technology at finding silver, we find a lot more gold and better technology to find gold, then the price is going to drop. If we have a lot of trouble finding silver and gold in the future, or suddenly everybody wants to buy silver and gold for some reason, the price is going to go up. This is in essence a gamble, because all of those things are outside of the control of the person buying it. Whereas if you're buying something that creates a value, if you're buying ownership in a company that is trying to be profitable, trying to sell things to people that create value in their lives, you should expect profits there, within reason.
You ask a question, and it was a good question. What happens in a recession at the price of silver? And the answer, based on the last recession, is it will drop. Price of gold and silver both dropped in the last recession. Now, historically, if you go back a long time, gold and silver used to rise in periods of economic uncertainty. They don't do that anymore. They have reversed their position. And there's a very good reason for that. And the reason is that in India, and to perhaps a lesser extent in China, which are two huge economies, taken together, they're bigger than the economy of the United States. But particularly in India, gold is used as savings. So then in an economic downturn, people sell gold.
They don't trust the banks.
Right.
What we just saw Prime Minister Modi do by taking away the highest denomination out of the cash flow. It was the most used denomination in cash. It put people in a lot of trouble. They used gold during that time period to make the difference up.
So gold and silver are not what they appear to be. But there's a fundamental thing. You said you saw a lot of advertisements for silver. I recognize that. There is a very good correlation between the quantity of effort being used to sell something and its future price decline.
Yeah.
In other words, if you see a lot of people spending a lot of money trying to sell silver to you,
which is what advertisements for selling
right.
or investing in silver right. really are, is somebody has a lot of silver and they're trying to sell it.
Right.
Why are they trying to sell it if they believe it's a good investment vehicle? They own it. It's not like buying you know, when somebody says you should buy stocks, by definition, they don't own all the stocks. They're not trying. In a lot of cases, there are laws against them selling the stock that they own directly to you based on those advertisements. It's not always the case.
Well, you actually don't – frankly, you don't hear – you don't see on mass media, buy stocks. Stocks are going to go up.
Yeah, because there's laws against saying that.
But the point is that you have a couple of unregulated – you have several unregulated areas, and unfortunately you hear a lot about them on this radio station. The unregulated areas are commodities and things like the solar farm and so on that's going to sell out.
Flipping houses, going to seminars on that, buying and selling gold.
Those things are unregulated.
They're allowed to say whatever they want.
As securities. And as a result, people will come on there and they will try to convince you to pay them to do something, to buy something that they promise or suggest will make you rich. And the question you got to ask yourself when you hear that, if it's such a good deal, why aren't you buying it? Now, if Cramer gets on there and says, I want you to buy the XYZ stock. And he commonly will say something very, very interestingly in there. I currently own this stock. By admitting that he owns it, trying to get you to buy it from somebody else will cause the stock price to go up so he can sell it. And that is its own peculiar thing, but it's accepted as long as he tells you, I own it, because when you go to buy it, the price would go up. Now, in gold and silver, it doesn't work that way because Cramer's stock that he owns only has a limited number of it, so if a whole bunch of people go in and buy it, the price will go up. If a lot of people in the United States jump out there and buy silver, the price of silver probably will not go up because we're not the principal investors in silver anymore or gold. It's India and China and, to a lesser extent, Russia. I mean, so what we would likely to see at this point is, in a recession, several nations would start selling gold and silver, which would cause the price to fall. So there's your answer.
Yeah, and last week we mentioned something. I talked about Venezuela and Russia. And Venezuela last year at this time had to meet some bond payments, and they're back at the same place again. They're down to about $10 billion with a B reserves for the whole country. That's not a lot of reserves for a country. Most of it's in gold. Last year at this time, they made a big physical shipment of gold to Switzerland so that the Swiss could start selling it. Some of that's in silver. When a new bunch of gold or silver hits the market, it causes the price to drop. If somebody's sitting in Switzerland and they see that there's a bunch of gold suddenly on the market, or it's being released slowly, and they get to step in and buy it at a rate that's a little bit better than other people, because this isn't the same kind of exchange as like the stock market where everybody can buy it at the same time. The gold market depends on who you're talking to and what supplies they have. And, you know, you could turn to your neighbor and say, I'll buy all your gold coins for $50. And if they sell it to you, then you got a good deal. The same's true on a larger scale, in that the wholesale gold and wholesale silver market is very different than the retail gold and retail silver market. So if they buy up some of this gold and silver that Venezuela is putting out there, and they turn around and they say, all right, we're going to make a profit by selling this, by putting advertisements on the radio, if they really thought it was a great long-term investment, they'd just hang on to it. They wouldn't turn around and sell it immediately by spending money to put ads on the radio going out to everyone. Traditionally, in the past about 150 years, in a depression or a recession, gold and silver prices have risen. You go back further than that and you see the opposite. Well, we're in that opposite stage again now. And the reason why the opposite had occurred before is because in a recession, governments would go out and sell the gold and silver so that they could boost up the economy to bring the economy back. So that would lower the price of gold and silver. Well, they stopped doing that when they used gold and silver as the standard for their currency because they didn't want to mess their currency up to prop up their economy. So we have this short-term experiment that didn't last. It ended in the 70s, and we use that in the advertisements, or people say it in the advertisements to say this is the traditional way that gold and silver functions. It isn't. So typically, I would expect into the future, just like the last recession, that during recessions, you're going to see the prices for gold and silver drop, because if you're losing income elsewhere and you need the income, then you're going to sell gold and silver to make up the difference, just like Venezuela is doing now. And that's kind of the ins and outs of what we see in the commodity world right now. If a elderly lady bought silver and needs it for income and we have a recession, she's probably going to lose some money.
By the way, CNBC had a really good article about that I just looked at on how they could have gotten the healthcare bill to pass. Really easily.
Oh, I've got a good way. They could have gotten more votes.
No. The easy way to get the votes.
Oh, what's that?
Make health care premiums universally tax deductible.
That would be nice. It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen because they want the revenue. But the bottom line to it is, if they wanted to get the bill to pass and they wanted to bring in the moderates and let them jump on it, all they have to do is say, okay, for a business, healthcare premiums are tax deductible.
For a personal person, instead of a public person, should be the same.
And
it's not.
you know,
not always anyway.
And basically even offer tax credits to people who can't take the deduction, and it would pass.
And we're about out of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you can call us locally with voicemail
at 254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Listen to podcasts, read our philosophy, read the newsletter. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.